Hi everyone, it's Sparky. If you don't know me, I am a canine psychologist and I have been working in canine psychology and human psychology for over 30 years. I registered with the CMA, which is the Complementary Medical Association that is out of the UK. Also, I have other credentials as well that follow along with systems thinking and the work that we do with both humans and dogs and their relationships. So the work that we're doing today expands the audience that I'm trying to reach. What we're trying to do is to reach out to both professionals and to veterinarians, as well as dog parents like yourself. And what we want to do is to provide you with some insights on how medication decisions really are a group of people working together, a facilitated conversation that all three parties, you as a dog parent, you as a dog professional, and you as a veterinarian, come together and have a conversation. So I'm going to be covering that off today. It's a very balanced discussion, and I hope you enjoy it. So in chapter one, we're going to first start talking to dog parents. Let's talk about building the foundation for medication decisions. And we're really going to dive deep into when medication is appropriate and when it isn't. If you spent any time researching anxiety medication for dogs, you'll have seen opinions pulling you in opposite directions. Some people will tell you medication is the first step. That if your dog struggles with anxiety, medication is the only way they'll ever calm down. Others warn you that medication dulls your dog's personality, turning once lively dogs into disconnected or subdued versions. But here's the truth. Medication can support change, but it can't create it. Before medication can make a difference, your dog needs one essential foundation, trust. Now, the trust I'm talking about is when your dog feels unsure, yet still turns to you for guidance. It's the trust that shows up when your dog pauses in a moment of anxiety, choosing to check in with you instead of reacting on their own. And that kind of trust, it's built over time. Not with commands or corrections, but with connections and consistency. If your dog can't pause in their uncertainty and look to you for guidance, if they're stuck in an endless loop of anxiety, medication might not have the effect you're hoping for. That's why in my past practice, I've always used a simple but powerful tool before considering medication, a 3 to 4 week period of trust building. It's not about asking whether your dog's anxiety is bad enough for medication. It's about asking a different question. Is there still room for trust to develop? Because if there is, even just a little, that's where you start. I ask clients to commit to 3 things during this period. A weekly check-in to discuss observations, sharing videos of key moments so that I can see their dog's patterns firsthand, and submitting a daily journal on their dog's behavior. And if they can commit to that, then I work with them. So that's really key because each of those is an investment, just not in money, but it's also an investment in energy and time. And all of those things have to come into play if we're going to change that behavior for life. Okay? This process of weekly check-ins and sharing videos of key moments and submitting a daily journal, these help me to understand 2 critical things. And this is important for those of you out there as dog professionals. First, we determine, is there potential for trust to grow? And second, have I seen enough evidence to make a compelling case for medication? Because I have to be convinced. And as we go through this episode, you're going to see how the role of a dog behaviorist, a professional dog behaviorist, can change from what we know. And I'm going to address the risk that I have faced and that if you're a dog professional, you have faced, and why we don't normally step in any sort of medication role. We keep a Chinese wall, so to speak. And I'm going to go into that more and address it, because there's room for us to grow as a profession. Medication should never replace relationship building. Without trust, medication is unlikely to lead to lasting change. Now, the role of the professional in supporting medication decisions is what I'm going to talk about next. For behavior professionals listening, I know you've been told not to diagnose or prescribe, and rightly so. But that doesn't mean you play a backseat role. You have a pivotal role to play. That role is a facilitator. Okay? So your job is to ensure decision makers have the information they need, because psychoactive medication decisions need to be informed by collecting observations of symptoms, by tracking behavioral indicators, which later on I am going to go through in detail. It's about offering an informed opinion on whether medication might help in committed cases where trust building has stalled. Your role is in collecting data and preparing clinical behavior reports. And again, I'm going to go into that. Your role could be about advocating for the dog to their caregiver and, if needed, to their veterinarian. And if medication is prescribed, your role continues. You track behavioral indicators in progress. You submit addendums to the clinical behavior reports. And you revisit medication effectiveness with your clients. Because if a dog is on it short-term, a short-term medication role when you're dealing with trauma or chronic stress or chronic anxiety, you need at least 6 months, because you're dealing with the first 2 months where the dog is just absorbing and having the medication integrate. So you're dealing with 6 months. So if the dog looks like they'll need medication for longer, then you need to revisit the medication effectiveness with your clients. Because medication isn't a finishing line, right? It's part of an ongoing process. Okay, so let's talk about the veterinarian's role. Many veterinarians are hesitant to prescribe medication for behavioral issues. And that's fair. There are over 92 psychoactive medications available to veterinarians, far more than commonly prescribed flohexidine or trazodone. Flohexidine being Prozac is the brand name, and trazodone, I think it's just trazodone. Knowing which medication to use, when to prescribe it, and how it may affect a dog's behavior is a significant challenge. And many vets just don't want to take on the risk. However, the dog's life and the quality of that life is sometimes necessary for us to consider psychoactive medication and to know which psychoactive medication is the best one considering the dog. But there's something that makes this decision easier. Clear information. I've seen this happen many times in my practice. A detailed clinical behavior report, one that combines the dog's history, environmental stressors, and a clear behavior pattern, can be the turning point. A well-structured report isn't just paper, it's insights. It reveals what's driving the behavior, what efforts have already been made, and where the medication might play a role. And if you think that that's just a vet's role, it's not. It's also the behaviorist's role. And I'm going to show you how that can play out. With this information, vets can make decisions with confidence, knowing they are supporting the dog's well-being with a surety and with all the information to make that critical turning point, that critical decision, should it be valid. Okay. So let's talk about the fear of medication. If your dog's system isn't stable enough to build trust, that's when medication may be needed. And here's where caregivers often get stuck. Fear. Now, I want to share a clip from a veterinarian whose video has over 36,000 views on YouTube. That's 36,000 people that have watched this. And it's a prime example of what many caregivers face, that moment when you're seeking help, but what you hear leaves you feeling even more uncertain. So let's play that clip.
For separation anxiety, you may want to be cautious that this stuff has a bunch of serious potential side effects. In this video, I'm going to be showing you my top natural remedies for dog anxiety.
Are you looking to learn more about natural pet health and wellness?
The most common side effects affecting up to 15% of dogs: vomiting, diarrhea, lethargy. Some dogs will have increased drinking, decreased appetite, and aggression. Some dogs can even have seizures and tremors. Have had biliary disease or liver disease, that is a...
What you just heard reflects a common problem. The message plays on fear, focusing heavily on potential side effects without explaining the full picture. Yes, Clomacom, like any psychoactive medication, carries risk. Side effects are possible. But here's the key point missing from this kind of messaging. Side effects are not the same as outcomes. We see the same risk profile in natural supplements, CBD, valerian root, and melatonin that he mentions can all alter your dog's behavior, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. The difference isn't about whether something is natural or synthetic. It's got nothing to do with that. It's about whether the right system in your dog's brain is being supported. In other words, the goal isn't to avoid change. It's to understand what kind of change your dog's system needs. That is why tracking matters. Without tracking things like your dog's sleep, their patterns, their stress reactions, or emotional shifts, you won't know whether a supplement, a medication, or even a behavioral plan is actually working or making things worse. This is the gap I see so many caregivers fall into. They're handed a prescription or supplement without knowing how to measure success. And that's where caregivers and professionals can take back control. So there are five gaps that are being widely broadcast to dog parents and to dog behaviorists and to vets that we need to address. So, for example, side effects don't prove medication is dangerous. Natural isn't always automatically safer. Medication shouldn't change your dog's personality. And if it does, it's the wrong medication. Medication isn't a last resort. Sometimes it's the first step. And medication doesn't mask the problem. It creates learning space. So each of these gaps can feel overwhelming. But here's the thing. Every one of these fears is a point where behavior professionals can step in to provide clarity. So let's explore alternative options to medication. So CBD, big push on CBD for dogs, and it's gaining attention. You've probably seen a Facebook ad on it, or you've seen it on Instagram, or you know, you've captured it in one of your social medias. Well, CBD has some research showing encouraging results, particularly for acute stress situations like car rides or short-term separation anxiety. Now, acute is very specific here. Acute means like one time and excessive. But I'm going to tell you something. For chronic stress, chronic anxiety, trauma, CBD does not have the backing. And CBD isn't risk-free. Dogs can experience the same side effects as medication: drowsiness, diarrhea, or changes in appetite. And just like medication, dosage and timing are crucial. So natural doesn't always mean safer. The key is understanding what's happening inside your dog and how to support them based on those insights. So that's where we need to look at making informed decisions, tracking neurotransmitter patterns. This is where we really need to track observable behavior patterns. By mapping those patterns to neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine, or GABA, you create a roadmap that helps you and your vet understand what's happening inside your dog's brain. Now, a dog professional is likely going to be able to do it better, but dog parents can also try it themselves with the information that I'm providing you. The reason I say that dog professionals are likely to be better at this is because they are taught and study day in, day out dog signals. So when we're looking at observable signals and they map it to what's happening inside your dog's brain, they will be able to see more signals simply because they practice constantly and they practice on multiple dogs, so they can see things a little bit better. And when you know which neurotransmitter is out of balance, you can make better decisions. Whether that's medication or environmental adjustments or behavior work. That ends chapter 2, and in the next chapter, we'll explore how to map observable behaviors to key neurotransmitters that are in play, and how to understand those patterns can change everything about how to support your dog. If you've been following along in this episode, you know we've covered some pretty big questions. When medication may help, when it might not, and how to build trust is critical. But here's one piece we haven't tackled yet. How the brain actually works. Understanding this is key to making informed decisions, whether you're a vet, a dog behaviorist, or a dog parent, whether you're exploring medication, supplements, or environmental changes. Before we jump in, if you haven't already, please consider subscribing. And if you find this helpful, like the video, add a comment, and let me know your questions and experiences with medication. Did you know that if you sign up to become a member on our website, dogparentology.com, you'll receive thoughtful emails filled with insight, practical tips, and free infographics delivered right to your mailbox. And for those who want to go even deeper, our paying patrons unlock a whole new level of support, including exclusive guides, mini lessons, behind-the-scenes insights, and even one-on-one expert advice. It's designed to give you clear strategies, deeper understanding, and personalized help all at your fingertips. Now, you might be thinking, well, that I can't afford that. It's too expensive. It's the price of a cup of coffee a month. That's it. So really trying to make it affordable, but still get the information out. We really rely on our patrons. So if that's something that interests you, love to see you there. Now, the brain's key players, I want you to meet Reggie, Tom, Viv, and Conrad. To explain the brain clearly, I like to use this cast of characters, each representing a different part of the brain that influences behavior. Reggie, you can think of her, try to remember her through being the regulator. She represents the autonomic nervous system, the system that controls your dog's automatic responses like breathing, heart rate, or fight and flight response. Tom represents the limbic system, like the amygdala, the emotional center that manages things like bonding, fear, anxiety, and feelings of safety. Viv, which is rarely talked about, represents
the vestibular system.
And she's responsible for movement, coordination, and balance, which is so essential when we're dealing with trauma issues, chronic stress, chronic anxiety. And Conrad represents the prefrontal cortex, right here, the thinking, problem-solving, and decision-making center of the brain. Together, these systems shape how your dog feels, reacts, and behaves. For listeners who want to know more about Reggie, Tom, Viv, and Conrad, I do explore their roles in greater detail in previous episodes, so I'll link that in the description for you to check out. Now, to understand how those brain systems connect together, those characters, we're going to imagine your dog's brain as a bustling city filled with highways and side streets and bridges. Messages or signals need to travel those routes to keep the system running smoothly. Reggie runs the major highways, the fast automatic responses that handle danger, excitement, or relaxation. Tom is the busy marketplace, packed with social cues, emotions, and bonding signals. Now, Viv controls the transit network, ensuring movement, balance, and coordination flow properly. And Conrad? He's like the city control tower, guiding decisions, problem-solving, and self-control. Now, those messages don't happen. They're delivered by neurotransmitters, chemicals that act like couriers. Some neurotransmitters carry messages that promote calm and relaxation, like serotonin and GABA. others like dopamine or norepinephrine, and they can increase energy, focus, or motivation. And here's the tricky part. Just like a city's traffic, when one route becomes congested or blocked, it can create a ripple effect across the entire system. That's why understanding neurotransmitters is so crucial, because changing one system can unintentionally affect another. If we imagine this is serotonin, and if we change it, the dopamine might rise or fall. And if this is GABA, and we increase GABA or norepinephrine, it could be influenced, right? Same way. So in many ways, it's like adjusting the water pressure in your house. Tighten one tap and the pressure in another room may change. And the relationship between these chemicals is not fully understood. And that is why medication decisions must be grounded in observations, not assumptions. But research now shows that we're getting better at crossing that barrier with medications and therapies designed to influence neurotransmitter activities. That's why tracking your dog's behavior is essential. Because even well-intentioned changes can ripple through their system in unexpected ways. So how does this connect to your dog's behavior? Let me connect it all together. Here's what we know. Certain behaviors are linked to specific neurotransmitter patterns. For example, serotonin imbalances. Dogs may show increased pacing, have sleep disturbances, or excessive licking. Where dopamine overload, this may appear as compulsive behaviors like difficulty pausing before reacting or high intensity bursts of frustration. Now, GABA deficiency, the dogs may seem hypervigilant, constantly scanning their environment, unable to settle even in calm moments. Norepinephrine surges, you may see sudden panic, exaggerated startle responses, or dogs who appear on edge without clear triggers. And that's not all. Combination of neurotransmitter shifts can create complex behavior patterns that don't fit neatly into one category. So let's turn our attention to daily journal indicators and how they can track the right patterns. When I worked with clients, I recommended that they track specific indicators that reveal patterns linked to neurotransmitters imbalances. I didn't necessarily tell them that I was looking for those patterns. I just said, watch and track these behaviors and tell me what's happening. Now, these aren't just isolated behaviors. They're patterns that show up across different moments in your dog's day. In your daily journal, I recommend tracking things like sleep patterns. Was their sleep deep, restful, or disturbed by frequent waking? Events, by events, I mean stress reactions. What triggered your dog's anxiety or fear or reactivity today? Did your dog pause to check in with you when they were feeling unsure? And then did they pause before reacting? Did they hesitate? Did you see them freeze before barking, lunging, or retreating? That's really key. And then emotional spillover. Was there a notable shift in behaviors after a stressful moment? Energy changes. Did your dog seem overcharged, sluggish, or difficult to engage? Restlessness or pacing. Did they struggle to relax, even in calm environments? Comfort-seeking behaviors. Did your dog actively seek out your presence for reassurance, avoidance, or withdrawal? Was your dog absent from moments where they would normally engage? These types of insights and more, collected consistently, reveal far more than an isolated incident or even grouping them together, say my dog barks all the time. They highlight the deeper pattern tied to your dog's internal state. Chapter 4, your role isn't passive, it's pivotal. Whether you're a dog behavior professional, a veterinarian, or deeply invested dog parent, the moments that lead up to that medication decision aren't just technical, they're relational. A decision made in consideration of the whole system dynamic and full of risk and potential. For professionals supporting this process, the question is, what do we do before medication is even on the table? What's our duty to the dog and to the science? Let me tell you what I do. I never bring the word medication into the room until a few things are clear. Until trust has been attempted between the client and the dog. Until tracking has begun and I have 3 to 4 weeks of data and have analyzed it. Until a system, even a shaky one, is trying to emerge. So here's what I want behavior professionals to know, and here's what your role can include. Expand your role to include facilitating productive, accurate discussions. Expand your role to include facilitated, productive, accurate discussions with your vet and client. You may not prescribe, but you can ensure conversation is clinically informed and fact-based. You have a plan and expectation for data collection through a 3 or 4 week trust-building observational program with your clients before supporting any medical intervention. This includes structured exercise like the human canine paralanguage method or the sensory positive experiences and balance exercise. And I'll include links in the description to those to help refresh those that may not remember what those are. Plus, you have anywhere from 21 to 28 days of collection of data points through daily journals. I mean, that's huge. Not just of the dog's behavior, but the caregiver's state too. We need to know if dysregulation is systemic, not just in the dog. From this, you can create a clinical behavior report that facilitates a non-emotional collaborative conversation. Now, that report should include behavioral observations over time, patterns in the white pathway, that's that hesitation, trust seeking and the recovery rate, sleep, and the quality of that sleep. It should also include neurobiological interpretations. For example, possible low serotonin signs. Systems cluster mapping were helpful. This isn't a diagnostic table. It's a hypothesis building tool. Clearly stating in your report that cluster analysis is provided to support discussion, not determine treatment. It should include citations and research summaries, ideally of similar cases where certain neurotransmitters may be under construction. Provide research-backed insights into system clusters and neurotransmitter systems. This helps bridge the gap between observable behavior and internal state. But, and this is crucial, it must be framed as investigatory, not conclusive, not prescriptive. Your language matters here. You're offering a lens, not a label. You might have heard me talk about symptom clusters, so why would we use them at all? Why would we cluster symptoms together? Because they help vets understand why a medication might be considered, not just what the symptoms are. Think about a dog showing restlessness, repetitive behavior, poor sleep, and even self-harm. That's not just a bad behavior case. It may indicate a multi-system imbalance, often involved with low serotonin and high dopamine. Now, you're not diagnosing, but you're giving the vet a reason to consider classes like SSRI or MAOIs because the behavior is presenting in a cluster known to respond to those interventions in certain cases. That's valuable, that's ethical, and that's useful. I want to be really clear. Behavioral pharmacology is not a game of guesses. This is why the vet's role is so important. But we can't ask vets to decide with partial information, especially if they're not able to see or are trained in daily behavior observations. So your job as a professional in the behavior space is to bring that information forward to them accurately, thoughtfully, and with integrity. Because the alternative, vague anecdotes, unrecorded stress events, and fearful guesses, it doesn't serve the dog. It doesn't serve the dog parents nor the vet. Okay, what comes next? This topic of cluster mapping, neurotransmitter pattern recognition, and structured reporting deserves more space than what I can cover here. I've created a guide and a template, including a full chart, decision-making frameworks, and example clinical report language, and a clinical behavior report. And I can teach on this subject if there is interest. So let me know in the comments, would you? But for now, if you're a behaviorist wondering where your role begins and ends, well, it begins with observation. It deepens with trust building. And it becomes pivotal the moment you help shift the conversation from fear to clarity. Thank you for spending time with me today. And if today's episode brought you clarity or helped some of the weight you've been carrying, I'd be so grateful if you would consider subscribing, liking the video, or leave a comment. It helps more dog parents and professionals find this kind of balanced conversation, this type of research, all given with the mission to keep more dogs in homes. If you'd like to go deeper, my Patreon page is where I share exclusive resources, practical guides, and one-on-one support. And your support there means a great deal. Next time, we'll take on a different challenge. Traveling with your dog. I'll walk you through a recent hotel experience that turned unsafe very fast and what every caregiver needs to pack to keep their dog safe. Because pet friendly doesn't always mean safe. And knowing what to expect, oh, it can make all the difference. Hey, thanks everybody for watching. I hope you have a great day. Bye for now.